Welcome to the Archives of the Loralee Show, conversation for exploration, timeless discussions to challenge and expand our worldview. And while you may find our guests fascinating, the views expressed may not necessarily reflect those of our own or of the Cuyamangue Institute. That's why we call it Conversation for Exploration. And join in our ongoing live events, interviews, our own presentations, and much, much more as we go exploring. Learn more at CuyamangueInstitute.com and Loralee.com. And hello there, I'm Loralee. Thanks for tuning in to Conversation for Exploration. As you know, I love it when ancient wisdom traditions find their confirmation in modern science, and we have one such topic on that tonight, on meditation as medicine. This is the title of a new book by Dharma Singh Khalsa. He's a physician as well as a yogi, an American Sikh, and you might be familiar with his earlier works, Brain Longevity and The Pain Cure. He's a doctor specializing in pain management and anti-aging medicine. He's also the president and the medical director of the Alzheimer's Prevention Foundation, and we join him from Tucson, Arizona. Hello, Dharma. How are you?
Good, Loralee. Good to be with you.
You're an American who some time ago found a wisdom tradition that you have taken up very seriously. Could you tell us, just to put this into context, a bit about your spiritual tradition?
Well, it's an interesting story. I was finishing my residency in San Francisco back in 1978, a while ago, and moved to Albuquerque, New Mexico for my first hospital position. When I got there, I decided I'd like to take a yoga class because I had been practicing basic hatha yoga and had took transcendental meditation, the TM program, when I was working in San Francisco. I figured if it was good enough for the Beatles, it was good enough for me.
And Merv Griffin.
And exactly, and many others too. And so I was there, you know, doing the basic stuff. Funny how the universe works. I asked a friend of mine, John Azar, who is a contractor, asked his wife, Leslie, who was reading one of those early alternative kind of newspapers back then. I said, Leslie, I would like to take a yoga class. So she just opened to a page, just off the cuff and pointed to one and said, oh, take that one. That looks good. I said, okay. So off I went to this yoga class, and it was in a house. And I went in, and there were these funny pictures on the wall, and out came this guy, and a young guy in a turban and a beard, a red beard, and he sat down and started doing these breathing techniques and things like that. And I started doing it, and I said, yeah, wow, this is for me. So I started practicing and doing Kundalini yoga. This was Kundalini yoga as taught by Yogi Bhajan, Bhajan. And it took about 2 years of really in-depth study and practice before I had the opportunity to meet Yogi Bhajan. And I had a series of very extraordinary circumstances culminating in Thanksgiving 1981 when I did a very advanced yoga class with him called White Tantric Yoga. I put on a turban on the same day and decided at that point that I no longer had to use these powerful anesthetic drugs to put people to sleep, but could actually use these techniques that I was learning, the meditation as medicine, to help people wake up and heal themselves in their body, their mind, and the spirit, and open up their consciousness. But, everybody has their own path, and you know, it didn't happen overnight. It took a long time for me to work out my own karma, as they say, until I could get to the point today where I'm able to be clear and teach people. So that's what I'm doing, and that's basically how I got into it. I think you wanted to know about the Sikh religion, which is different from the yoga. Sikh religion is a simple thing. It's about 500 years old, started in northern India, and it basically has a belief that there's just one creator of the creation. There's many ways to that. And this is just one way, and that the main purpose of life is to help other people. So that's what that's about.
It's a good mandate. Mm-hmm. You're a Harvard-educated medical doctor on the one hand, and a follower of a very ancient spiritual tradition on the other hand, and I just find that merger fascinating and very rich territory. You've specialized a lot in also anesthesiology, and you said that you've used some of these techniques to put people to sleep. Is that from
what application? No, I use drugs to put people to sleep, but
I was just going to say, is this also possible? But go ahead.
Well, I think it's useful. When I was an anesthesiologist and had become a Sikh and was practicing yoga, I was really sought after to help people get through difficult surgeries. Number one, I was a calming presence in the operating room, but beyond that, I could also help people relax by teaching them simple techniques in a rapid way so that they could get themselves into a good mental state before their surgery. And I especially was useful in obstetrical anesthesia, which I specialized in for a while, really helping women relax and get ready for the birthing process. So I've used meditation as medicine not only now to help people, you know, deal with specific illness that Western medicine can't touch, but also I've mixed it with conventional medicine in the hospital as a regular old doctor.
You know, my mother was taught meditation by one of the social workers at her doctor on his orders. He said, you need to meditate. So I think it's great that it's getting so widespread. And of course, you would have to sell it to most Westerners, not on its spiritual benefits, but on its health benefits.
In preparing to write the book, I did a research project and actually commissioned the Roper Center, which is like the Gallup poll people. Actually, I originally called Gallup, and they said call Roper, which I think is at the University of Vermont, and found out something very interesting indeed, that at that time, and I'll bet it's more now, close to 20% of the American public had tried meditation, which I figured out at the time is, it's like almost 50 million people or something like that.
Wow.
And if you put in prayer, which many people consider meditation, and I think it's not really, it's related to it, but it's not meditation. But when you,
I find my meditation is more powerful when you pray beforehand, when I pray beforehand, but that's just an aside. Go ahead.
Yeah, I think there are two different things, actually. Mm-hmm. But if you follow the basic precepts, you can probably get the same response. But anyway, beyond that, so if you include prayer in meditation, it's something like almost 100% of Americans have tried it at one time or another.
Uh-huh.
So what I've found, though, is the interesting thing in talking and speaking with people and lecturing and things like that is that many, many people tried it and either don't feel they're doing it right or they've quit because they say, quote, you know, I can't blank out my mind when I'm doing it. And I'll bet a lot of people involved in this website discussion are going to say the same thing. You know, well, I've tried it, but you know, I just can't do it. I'm really bad at it because my mind won't stop. I have thousands of thoughts.
Our listeners, they're very advanced in these things. But go ahead.
Pardon?
You'd be surprised at our listeners. They're very advanced in these things.
Well, it's always good to review. So the thing is that when this happens, what I'm finding is it's very simple just to tell people that, you know, go back and start all over again in favor whatever technique or tool they're using, whether it's the breath or a mantra. And let the thoughts, the point I'm trying to make is that the thoughts coming mm-hmm. into the mind is the process of meditation. And it's like a friend of mine said, you know, who's a country boy, it's like sweeping out the barn. Sometimes you get some nice sweet dirt and sometimes you get something else. But I've been meditating as long as, you know, pretty long time now, about 25, 30 uh-huh. years. And, you know, the last time that happened to me was this morning. So even advanced meditators need to be reminded from time to time that when, you know, that sometimes you can carry on two or three conversations in your head while you're meditating if you have very powerful techniques and you're good at it. Uh-huh. The thing to do is go back and favor whatever it is you're using, your breath or your mantra or even your posture or your movement, whatever it happens to be.
You're so correct, because my mother calls up and she goes, well, I don't think I'm doing this right. She expects some sort of bliss state immediately. And I said, no, Mom, that comes after years. That comes from a gift from God. That comes unexpectedly, but it's not a daily thing that you're going to experience. The point of the meditation is the after effect, the physiological benefits. That's what you're doing this for. The spiritual stuff can come on its own.
Yeah, so, by the way, I think we should talk about both of those things. The grace thing that you mentioned is a beautiful thing, and it can happen that way. But also, there was a guru about 400 or 500 years ago named Nanak, N-A-N-A-K. He was known as the first master. And Guru Nanak issued an order to his followers. He said, Japa, J-A-P, which means repeat. So I think what you're saying is true. Yeah, it can happen by the grace of God, but the key is to jap, to repeat, to meditate every single day.
To habituate your physiology.
Pardon?
To habituate your physiology to sustain the process, right?
Yeah, it's like behavioral conditioning, although it wears off. You do have to do it every day because sleep disrupts that.
Yeah.
So you do have to do it every day. It's something that you have to do on a regular basis. That's why even the most basic form of meditation, for example, the relaxation response, it's called the regular elicitation of the relaxation response. So it has to be done, it has to be done on a regular basis. Guru Nanak also said that the best time to do this, he called it the Amrit, A-M-R-I-T, Amrit Vela, V-E-L-A, the time of the nectar. the early morning hours before the sun comes up. That is because when the hormones of the body are starting to rise themselves, the cortisol, the stimulating adrenaline, all the good stuff, the serotonin, the dopamine, all these different chemicals are starting to come up in the brain. And if you just jump right into your day, for example, the commercials on TV now tell us the best part of waking up is coffee in our cup or some kind of drug in water to stimulate ourselves, get us right back in the arousal state. That's not true at all. The best part of waking up to balance your hormones and your chemicals to make sure that you're not over-anxious or depressed but have a smooth day is to get into what I call the fourth state, as opposed to being awake, and hopefully everyone who's with us now is awake, or the sleep state. Hopefully no one's asleep. When you're asleep, hope you dream. So that's the awake state, the sleep state, and the dream state. Those are the first three states. But then we have that fourth state, which is the transcendent state, the meditative state, the neutral mind, the meditative mind, or the sacred space. It doesn't matter what you call it. I happen to like the sacred space, but this is where all healing occurs. And as you said, after a certain amount of time, some studies show it can take 5 years before the person really starts to tune in and polish that spiritual essence within themselves, but I think it happens right away as well. You know, that's what happens when you spend, the more time a person spends in the fourth state, studies, medical studies are showing the better their health is, the happier they are, the more joyous they are, and actually, no matter what's going on in their life, they feel better about it.
I agree with you that this is a natural state of consciousness. It just generally gets pushed out in our busy lives, and so we do need to spend time to befriend it and get comfortable there and allow the physiology to rest there in order to access that more easily. I agree with you on that. And I was wondering, too, there's been so many thousands and thousands of studies on the efficacy of prayer as a healing process. You said meditation is different. What studies have been done to demonstrate the powerful physiological benefits of meditation? And what are some of the brain chemicals? This is my second question that I know is going to enter into this. I know that you've really looked at lowering levels of cortisol, the stress hormone that's toxic to the brain and brain longevity.
Yeah.
And what are those chemicals in the brain, and how are they affected by the process of meditation?
Okay, good. Those are good questions. Do you want to start with the things about studies on meditation?
Yeah, let's start there, sure.
Okay. Again, I looked at this, obviously, and there are at least 1,000 medical, properly done, high-level academic medical research studies in the last 30 years that have been done on meditation grouped as a whole. Now, we can break that down into transcendental meditation, which has probably the best-funded studies. They get a lot of their money from the government and other academic agencies, that's true, but also they have a way of funneling a lot of the money that they take in by selling the TM technique back into research, so I think that's very good. They have over 500 studies. Then you mentioned Dr. Benson at Harvard. Dr. Benson has done a number of excellent studies over the years with the basic relaxation response. Then you have mindfulness meditation. John Kabat-Zinn is the researcher who's done the most research on that. And then there are other types of meditations and studies on that. And most recently, the type I talk about in Meditation is Medicine, my new book, I call it Medical Meditation. And in fact, there are some interesting studies, although it's, you know, just coming out. Most of them are just coming out now. There have been a number of those as well. I think the two best that I like about medical meditation, and then I'll go back, talk about the others, is one that was done by a researcher, a PhD in health psychology. She has a name like me. She's a Sikh. Her name is Shanti, S-H-A-N-T-I, Shanti, calls a PhD. And she did an interesting study with advanced AIDS patients. And she showed that patients who did medical meditation, the kind that I talk about in the book, had a one-time effect for self-efficacy. That means that the patients who did it had such a profound emotional response to the meditation, such a strong healing effect, that they felt that what they did made a difference after only one time doing it. And others...
That's powerful medicine.
Yeah, others don't show that. So that was a good study that she did. And the latest one that I like is another fellow that works with Dr. Benson at the Harvard School of Medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital, and he designed the study, but the woman who did the study was Dr. Sarah Lazar, And that showed that comparing medical meditation to basic meditation, we see that medical meditation had a stronger effect. It was more profound in that it touched areas of the brain that were not touched by basic meditation. They compared the two. So the medical meditation actually sent action energy into areas of the brain such as the hippocampus, which is the memory center of the brain, the amygdala, which is an emotional center, something called the cingulate gyrus, which has to do with changing or transferring information between brain hemispheres. So we see that when you substitute some of the ancient mantras for picking any word you want or using your breath, you get a much more profound effect. But you know, even the body, this is an important point, the body has such an incredible ability to heal itself if we just give it a chance, that even the most basic, simple meditation has a very strong effect. For, you know, the body, I don't think anyone listening has ever died from a cut finger. I mean, the body knows how to heal itself, whether it's a cold or a cut or even serious illness. If we just give it a chance, it can heal itself. Meditation happens to be, I think, the body's most powerful natural medicine to activate that healing force. And that's what studies show. For example, I mean, there's just so many. The TM people have done so many studies that show that every single illness from the top of the head to the tip of the toes, if there was one on the toes, I don't know, but even infertility, for example, is improved through the process of meditation. They showed, as we said, that the bad hormones went down and the good hormones went up, and we can talk about that and name that. But I think one of the best studies on meditation, which really gets me excited, is the one they did with elderly people. They did this in a nursing home over 3 years, and they taught one group transcendental meditation in this case, and another group did not meditate. And at the end of the 3 years, 0%, no people in the meditation group had died. These were elderly people compared to, I don't know the exact number, but it was statistically significant that a certain number of people died in the non-meditating group. So I think that, you know, you have all this talk about anti-aging medicine, Ron Klatz from A4M, and Dr. Ron Klatz is a good friend of mine, but I think the push towards hormone replacements and drugs and things like that is not doing everybody the best service. I think that meditation is really the true anti-aging medicine, along with exercise. Exercise is important. But everyone forgets about meditation because the physiology that meditation elicits or creates is so helpful, so beneficial to the underlying nervous system, which is connected to the immune system. You have your thoughts, your nervous system, and your immune system. And by connecting those three, you know, you get a phenomenal anti-aging effect. So I think that meditation is really the most powerful form of natural medicine that we have. And in the book, Meditation's Medicine, we spend the beginning of the book talking about we talk a little bit about my story, and then we get into the science of it, and then go through the energy centers or the chakras, showing how when they get out of balance, certain problems happen in the organs related to those centers, and then how medical meditation can actually target the specific energy centers and specific illnesses. So the difference between basic meditation or transcendental meditation or mindfulness is that it's sort of one size fits all. You do relax, you slow your body down, you slow the rhythm down, which is healing. Medical meditation actually targets the specific areas. It's like medicine. What's medicine? Well, you go to a doctor, and medicine is good. I mean, we need it. You go to the doctor, you have a specific illness, you get a drug, let's say you have a let's make it more specific, you have a heart problem. He doesn't give you, the doctor, he or she does not give you medicine for your stomach. So why should everyone do the same meditation technique? If you have a heart problem, you want to do a meditation for the fourth energy center or for the heart. And in the book, Meditation's Medicine, I show people how to activate the healing energy of that specific organ or energy center, and that's why it's so specific and individualized. It's like using the right tool for the job. You know, if you want to hammer in a nail, you don't get a screwdriver, you get the hammer, and that's what basically the book's all about.
I'd like to hear about those specific meditation techniques. I know that you use such things as specific breathing patterns, mudras, which are hand and finger positions, use particular mantras. I want to hear about that in a moment. But let's first review this whole idea of the concept of medicine, because I agree with you. Here in our Western material culture, we think medicine must be drugs. We must manufacture them outside the body artificially through a bunch of chemicals, deliver them to the body, and that's what's going to do the magic. I have two questions on that. First of all, drugs being where we can substitute or get the brain to stimulate and produce its own perfectly manufactured and perfectly balanced biochemicals is a far better application for those chemicals than trying to administer them, right? I agree with that. The second question is, you talked about delivering energy to a specific organ. Now, we think in terms of chemicals going in and doing the job, but we also, and you talk also about the body's ethereal as well as physical and chemical aspects. What is it that meditation can do, or tapping into that eternal part of our soul via meditation, that natural part of us that I think is anchored in higher consciousness, whatever life force, whatever you want to call it? What is it about that that stimulates energy being delivered to the body, and how is that energy medicine?
You know what, Laura Lee, these are awesome questions. I mean, you're very brilliant when it comes to this meditation, so let's see if I can answer them in the order that you brought them up.
I don't care about the order. This is a free-for-all. It's organically grown interview.
These are great questions. Let me just start by saying that it's been my experience, my observation, that we've been programmed in the West, and I'm Western, even though I've adopted a Sikh lifestyle, Eastern lifestyle. I am totally Western. You know, I'm into baseball and all that stuff.
But, all-around balanced guy. I like that.
All-around, all-American guy, but sort of. But anyway, here in the West, we have been totally programmed to look outside of ourselves for satisfaction and for gratification for just about everything. I mean, even religion, for example, you know, you go to the church or the temple or the synagogue, and you know that's where your experience is.
Or give me the magic bullet pill to cure me.
Yeah, right? You're taught that God is out there, or that you need a magic bullet pill, that you go to the doctor, doctor writes a prescription, gives you a piece of paper, you go to the pharmacy, and that's it. Now, I just want to say that I'm not against, again, I have to clarify this, I'm not against medicine. In fact, you know, I'm a doctor, and I think medicine is indicated in many cases. So
I agree with you.
We should say that, you know, I don't want anyone out there to think that I'm, like, against medicine. I just see the treatment of an illness or even health and wellness as a spectrum. The problem is that conventionalists think they're the dot. You know, that their little dot on the spectrum.
The end all and be all,
yeah. When there's really, they are not the main thing. They are part of the spectrum. They're not the main dot. So the thing is that, you know, the body has an incredible ability to heal itself, as we said, but we're taught to look outside ourselves. But if we use a technique like meditation, we activate a number of things in our own body that help it heal. Just like we're giving a drug from the outside, we can get our own body's pharmacy, our natural pharmacy, to release the proper chemicals, peptides, hormones, etc., that are in the brain. And then we know now that there is this mind-body connection, and even mind-body-spirit connection, that these, let's say you're doing a meditation and you release an endorphin in your brain. You know, endorphin is your feel-good chemical, your body's own morphine, except it's certainly not as deleterious to your health as taking heroin or morphine from the outside. It's good. It makes you feel good. So this endorphin will then go throughout the body. Let's say you have an inflammation somewhere. Let's say it's in your liver. You have a liver disease. So it goes to the liver, and it activates kind of a healing response there by stimulating what are called second and third messengers in the liver cell. And this goes deep into the cell, even to the DNA, and it says, hey, guys, it's time to get over this. Let's activate the healing response, and let's bring out the good chemicals. Let's bring out the cavalry kind of fight this illness. So that's the way it can work like that. Let me just say a quick word about the tenets of medical meditation as opposed to basic meditation.
Okay.
In basic, I think this is important to understand. In basic meditation, we have, you know, four things that are important. We have comfort, a comfortable position, quiet environment, some kind of tool to focus on, and then we have the thing we talked about before, the attitude, where you're going to start all over again. Now, in medical meditation, we keep those, but we add five new things, which are not hard at all. They're very simple and natural. First is breath. You know, we're taught that, you know, there's this yogic type of breathing, long, slow, deep breathing. That's very true. That's a yogi breath. But there are so many other kinds of breath there and that can be used in sequence or in combination with these other things to get a totally different response. There's a segmented breath. There's something called breath of fire. There's alternate nostril breathing, a lot of different breaths. Then we have a posture. So you have breath, you have posture. You mentioned them already, mantra, mudra, and focus. So the posture, you know, we have to balance the energy lines in the body. They call them meridians. We have to balance these lines. So let's say you're lying on your back and you want to do something for your gallbladder. You lift up your left leg with your hands behind your head at 30 degrees. This stimulates healing energy that goes across the body to the gallbladder. That's been shown for thousands of years. That's how it works.
Huh.
So posture is important, and we have that in the book on the third chakra and digestion. You'll see that. Okay, then you have breath, posture, you have mantra. Okay, this is a beautiful topic. It's a long topic, but this follows the principles of something called NAD, N-A-A-D, yoga, NAD yoga. NAD yoga is the science of the vibration. Every sound, you know, that old Zen thing, how does it go if you're in a forest and a tree falls? Do you hear it or something like that?
Well, better yet, modern science tells us that it's all a sea of vibrations. Every atom, every molecule, the space between the atoms, it's all just energy, wave, oscillating, right?
That's right. That's right. So in other words, if the tree drops and no one's there, there's no sound, but there is a vibration.
It may not... Right, it ripples through the air, but no ears to pick it up.
Exactly, you got it. So the NAD, the sound, the science of the sound current, and the ancient yogis were so phenomenally advanced at this stuff. I mean, they had sounds for every organ of their body, for every illness, without even knowing the names of them. But the sound currents that you pick can have a very dramatic effect, and here's the reason why. There are, in the upper palate of the mouth, there are 84 meridian points, acupuncture points, in the upper palate of the mouth. There's some located behind the teeth, some are located in that ridge behind the upper part of your mouth, some are located in the middle, some are located in the back, some are even on sort of the lips. But the lips are also very highly represented in the brain. So when you say a sound, let's say you're using, in the book, it's called the five primal sounds, or the mantra to heal mind, body, and spirit, and these are four words, sa, ta, na, ma, S-A-T-A-N-A-M-A, sa, ta, na, ma. This stimulates all the 84 meridian points in the upper palate, and this is like a simple movement, like striking a keyboard, then can have a very profound effect on the computer. It sends an energetic message to the master glands of the brain, especially the pituitary gland, which then kind of wakes up depending on the signal it gets and sends out its chemicals, orchestrates the symphony of healing chemicals throughout the body.
Laura Lee here on The Laura Lee Show. We continue our conversation with Dr. Dharma Singh Khalsa. His books include Brain Longevity, The Pain Cure, and just out, Meditation as Medicine, Activate the Power of Your Natural Healing Force. Okay, Dharma, you were telling us about the syllables based on the sound current science of these ancient yogis. Before we get back to that, I have to ask you, how did these ancients know so much? There are legends in the Vedic literatures, in many wisdom traditions, about advanced technologies, advanced civilizations way prior to our written histories. Do you believe that, or were they just intuitive? Did they have some sort of line out to higher states of consciousness? How did they accumulate all this wisdom?
You know, I think they were tuned in. They practiced this. They didn't have a lot of distractions that we have today. They didn't have technology, and basically from, you know, the there just seems to be something about that part of the world. I don't know if you've been to India.
I haven't.
No, yeah. Or if other people listening have, but when you go there, you just feel like you're turned around completely because the energy is totally different. That there's just something about being there, and you just hear so many stories about people who have had miraculous experiences there. I don't know, I just think it's something in the air there or something, but it just seems that they've been doing it for so long. That's what they were into. You know, here in the West, in the United States, we're into Wall Street. We're into making money. Uh-huh. We're into other things, and we're very good at it. Over there, they've been doing it a heck of a lot longer than we have, but they weren't into the money part of it. They were into developing this sixth sense that they had, or this fourth state, then they became very good at it. I think if you do something 8-10 hours a day, you're going to get good at it, and that's
and
what they did.
If you have a tradition that has been intact for many, many thousands of years, that in China and the Australian Aborigines are three cultures exceptionally long-lived and not cut off at the knees like our indigenous roots are.
Yeah, you know, and then they stayed with their lineage. For example, I have a very good friend who's what's known as a ragi, a singer of sacred music, which is part of Nad Yoga, and he's a 16th generation ragi. His great-grandfather, who I've met, who's 75 years old, you know, was a 13th generation ragi. So you stay with it. You learn from the time you're a little kid, you learn these things, and, you know, the people, they just passed wisdom down at master to student, and yeah. They learned how to perfect it. How they did it, I can't really say, but they definitely did it.
Now, back to the Sa Ta Na Ma. How do you sing that? Could you demonstrate for us?
Yeah, it's Sa Ta. Well, first of all, I should say that, when I started doing it, I realized my voice was too harsh. So the thing that you have to have, you know, let me just explain a little bit, if I could. In this part of India, where this tradition comes from, which is very near Tibet, in northern India, in a region called the Punjab region, there are two cities. One's called Dharamsala, the place of truth where the Dalai Lama lives. The other is called Amritsar, the place of immortality. It's called the city of immortality because they've developed techniques, their natural techniques, which are anti-aging. So the thing about it is there, these people who practice have very relaxed jaws. So that's the way you have to approach this. It's not, you know, sitting on the edge of your chair trying to use the English language. For example, there when they say, how are you? They say, ki hal hai. It's like their jaw is very relaxed. The answer to that is, tike, okay, I'm fine. But then if they want to say, how are you on a deeper level, they'll say, ki hal hai ji. How are you in your soul?
Ah.
And the answer to that is, chardikala. In the state of exaltation, which kind of goes back to what we were talking a little bit about before. When they greet each other, sometimes they just say, Chardikala, are you exalted? See, that is very important for them to be in on a regular basis. So you have to first approach it with a relaxed jaw, with the idea that you're going to free your voice. Then, you know, there's a kind of a cute exercise for that. You relax your jaw, you stick out your tongue and sort of clamp down on it, not too hard, and then you say something to someone like, hi, I'm Bob from Chicago. You know, you talk with your tongue out and your lips down. Hi, I'm Bob, I'm from Chicago. That's a good way. It kind of relaxes you, makes you laugh, and loosens up your jaw. Then once you're in that point, once you're at that place, you can start to sing or to chant the five primal sounds in a relaxed manner, so you'll get the effect of the activation of the 84 meridian points. There's a very well-known lecturer, Wayne Dyer, who talks about...
Oh, he's been a frequent guest here.
Pardon?
He's been a frequent guest here.
Yeah, he talks about meditating on Ah and manifesting your destiny. Ah is the fifth primal sound, but there are four others, Sa, Ta, Na, Ma. So those are four sounds, but the ah is common to all. That's the fifth sound. So it's much more potent when it comes to healing and manifesting your destiny and creating intuition and things like that, being your true natural self, who you really are, to use the five primal sounds. But you must have a relaxed jaw. Once you have the relaxed jaw, and you can chant the sounds. Now, there's a key, there's something else very important that we didn't talk about. There's a mudra to this, and the mudra is simply fingertip position. And what we find is, and this is Western, somehow they knew this, I don't know how, but this is Western, that there is an anatomical map of the brain that every single medical student, even psychology students, have to study this, where you see that the fingertips, all your five fingertips are light up. They're lit up in the brain. When you touch your fingertips, you're sending incredible energy and blood flow to the motor, what's called the motor sensory area of the brain. So this technique takes advantage of that, where you're touching your fingers and you're using the sounds at the same time in the nod style of creating the vibration. I hope that's
so you're stimulating a certain area of the brain by where your fingers touch, and then you're stimulating that even further by the activation of the sound vibration.
The sound vibration stimulates the pituitary. The fingertips stimulate the motor sensory area. So you're engaging the whole brain.
Got it.
Is what you're doing.
Okay.
So when you say the first sound, the sa, you're touching the index finger to your thumb with about, I mean, just like you're touching it on the table, about 10, little bit of pressure, 10 pounds of pressure, like you would hit hard a keyboard, overdoing it, something like that. Just banging it a little. I mean, you know, you want to put a little pressure, not so much pressure that it hurts, but a little bit so that it almost turns white.
Well, it's similar to the Chinese idea of stimulating the acupuncture points by pressure or by a needle or something.
Right,
or
not heat. Quite. Not you don't want to push too that hard, but it's the general idea.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's acupressure. So you stimulate them, you touch them in sequence. As you do the first sound, you touch your index finger. Second sound, your middle finger. Third sound, your ring finger. Fourth, primal sounder, and with the odds, the fifth with the pinky, so it's sa, ta, na, ma.
Okay.
And there's a focus of concentration, and that's simply imagine the sound coming in the top of the head and out the forehead. It's like an L form of meditation. So now that I've explained it, I can sort of sing it and chant it, so it goes like this. Sa, ta, na, ma. Sa, ta, na, ma. Sa, ta, na, ma. Then you would whisper it. Sa, ta, na, ma. And then repeat it. Well, you do the first two out loud for 2 minutes, then in a whisper for 2 minutes, then silently for 3 minutes. Keep touching your fingers, then in a whisper for 2 minutes, and then out loud again for 2 minutes. And this whole thing is beautifully explained in chapter 9 of the book. There's even a story about a woman named Nicole. It's called Nicole's Story, Healing Mind, Body, and Spirit, a woman who did this meditation to really heal her whole life after being in a train accident in which she was paralyzed. So it's a very powerful meditation.
You know, it sounds almost like a simple childhood rhyme. And what if children were taught this, as, you know, along with Mary Had a Little Lamb? Don't you wonder what effect it would have on children if they were to do this?
I think they'd be conscious when they were young. Well, children are already conscious when they're young, but hopefully they would keep the consciousness that gets drilled out of them by the time they're
eight. But I also think there's so many assaults on a child's brain today. Why kids have so much ADD? You know, they're not eating fruits and vegetables. They're getting all sorts of food chemicals. There's so many toxins in our environment. They're watching television. There's
sugar.
So many assaults. Sugar, thank you.
And
so
caffeine.
They need a little medicine.
It's amazing.
Really.
Kids drink more caffeine than adults do.
In Coca-Colas?
Yeah, in Coke and soft drinks. They drink, you know, for their body weight. Think about it. For their body weight, there it would be like, you know, the amount of soda that they drink, it would be like an adult drinking
three times as much.
You know, 10 of those big liter bottles or something. It's just wipes them out. It's too much.
Yeah. Agreed.
But actually, Herb Benson is doing a couple of interesting studies now. This is fascinating. One he already did where he did simple studies of the meditative experience in children with disorders of behavior. And it was almost like playing that game. What's that game where you... The chair game, you know, musical chairs, where he kept removing one chair, and the kids would have to walk around without competition slowly, and when the music stopped, they would sit down in a chair, and they got into a kind of a trance walking around the chairs. Now he's gone back, and he's with older children, teaching them meditation techniques, the basic relaxation response, and looking at grades, and the response thus far is very encouraging. Showing that when you teach kids to relax, you lower their stress and they improve their grades, which makes sense. That's what athletes do.
Boy, it makes a lot of sense. How many athletes are utilizing these techniques?
I don't know exactly, but I think more and more are doing it. There's a lot of them who have learned what is called the mental training techniques of peak performance, which utilize visualization and affirmations and guided imagery. And I think now I know that there are a number of folks who are working with athletes, teaching them these similar energetic techniques that are found in medical meditation or meditation as medicine that get their energy up and help them focus a laser beam.
Look what a similar kind of techniques have done for Tiger Woods, who was taught from an early age.
Oh, yeah. Tiger Woods is incredible. He's brought athleticism into golf. And also, you know, Andre Agassi used a lot of these techniques. He's very focused, very powerful tennis player.
Interesting. Let's now review what some of the chemicals in the brain are and how these various techniques, through sound, through breath, through touching of the fingers, through what you call focus of concentration, which you haven't defined yet, how does that actually stimulate? Why should anything stimulate, you know, sound stimulate the pituitary gland? And what does the pituitary gland do for us? What are the bad chemicals in the brain? What are the good chemicals?
The pituitary gland is a little thing. It's about the size of the tip of your thumb that hangs out right back of the spot at the bridge of your nose. And what happens is this little organ is receptive to the chemicals from another gland called the hypothalamus, which is the brain's master brain. It's the brain's brain. And the pituitary gland is the master gland. And the hypothalamus secretes its so-called releasing factors, the pituitary. Pituitary then will send a message down to your thyroid that says, hey, thyroid, we need 2 ounces of thyroid today. You know, we're kind of sluggish. And then it'll say to other glands, you know, you need to turn it up or turn it down a little bit. That's what the pituitary does.
Why has it been associated with the third eye of consciousness?
Yeah, well, the Ajna chakra, the sixth chakra of intuition and creativity and openness is associated with the pituitary gland because when it secretes properly in its highest kind of form, it also allows the person to, as they say, know the unknown and see the unseen, or what I like to say is, precognition isn't so important, but taking the path of the soul is much more important, knowing what you're supposed to do in life, and that's what the sixth chakra or the pituitary gland helps you do.
So if you're functioning optimally, that job is a lot easier.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah. You know where you are.
Yeah.
You can see without looking. Mm-hmm. You know, like you can go without going, and you actually let things come to you. They happen effortlessly instead of you always hassling after things. Things come to you. It's much nicer that way.
And why?
Doesn't mean you don't have to do your work. You still have to do your work, but things come easier.
Well, you know, we think about our 5 physical senses, but I'm sure that there are many other receptor sensory machinery within us that are tuning into other levels of life.
Well, you're absolutely correct. And I think that as we go further into this, with, you know, this new age or whatever you want to call it, actually, truthfully, it's the Aquarian age, because in 1991, we entered a transition period between the age of Pisces into the age of Aquarius, and the key to survival in the Aquarian age is to have a self-sensory system where you respond not by anger and emotion and commotion and depression, but where you respond in your highest form and you respond sensibly with your sensory system. You feel things and you know what's going on and you act from a spiritual side rather from your lower kind of, you know, senses. So that's very important as we go further into the 21st century, definitely.
You know, Jean Ahl, who wrote the Clan of the Cave Bear series long ago, I never talked to fiction authors, but I did want to talk to her about something she wrote where she was projecting, you know, trying to figure out how did ancient people survive, our Neanderthal ancestors. And she described how they would go, this is her projection, but I think there's something to this, how a tribe would go as they were wandering in their hunter-gathering ways. They would go to a new place, they would pick up some of the earth, they would taste it, they would taste the plants, they would drink the water, and by that they could remember if any of their ancestors had been there before. That they had this kind of extrasensory perception. We call it New Age, but I think it's a very age-old survival mechanism that we have, and I think it's just a natural part of us, just that in our Western society, we think what you see is what you get.
Yeah.
It's a WYSIWYG world, and so we've tended to shut out a huge and important part of ourselves that we're now just reclaiming, but that the ancients have utilized for millennia, and in some wisdom traditions kept intact. So I think there's vast new areas of ourselves that we need to relearn and reclaim. It's a very exciting process.
Well, so, actually, Laura Lee, you're about 1,000% correct. I think that what's happened is we've just been totally shut down with our intuition and our precognition and our creativity and the path of our soul by everything that we do here in Western society. You know, from the time we're little, we are programmed, as I said, in a certain way, and obviously it's not all bad, but we're not programmed towards keeping that part of ourself open. I had a funny experience. I'll tell you what happened. I had been doing a lot of meditation. I was having a number of precognition experiences.
Yeah.
Some of them were, you know, I mean, it gets a little bit, gets your attention, let's put it that way. I was having some really intuitive experiences. So I was at my chiropractor. He's an old friend of mine. We've known each other close to 30 years now. And just went there for an adjustment, and then I was talking to him, and I was telling him about this. He said, well, you better start drinking some beer to shut that stuff down, you know?
Or smoke a cigar. That should do it as
well. You know, so, yeah. But I think that's true. I mean, the thing, and I thought, yeah, he's right. You know, so many people start their day, as we said, with a cup of coffee and then eat very stimulating foods all day. They don't ever get into the fourth state. There's so much stress. They have a couple cocktails or a beer or two at night, and that's part of the... Heard a guy on TV today talking about the Super Bowl. He said, "Yeah, we're having some adult beverages." I mean, that's what our standard operating procedure is, and all that stuff that we do, even our relationships and our jobs and the way we look at life, totally shuts down the opportunity that we have to heal ourselves naturally and to utilize meditation as medicine and to activate our own natural healing force and to develop our intuition to see ourselves as we really are and to reconnect with what I call our true self or our higher self. And that is really, to me, that is the purpose of life, is to reconnect with that spiritual essence of ourself, which makes for profound happiness. That is really the strength to give to other people.
That's the point of being a human. You know, so much money is spent on this war on drugs, and I'm going, what if they took that budget and they opened centers where anybody could walk in and you would be educated and provided systems to actually activate your brain to reach that spot naturally. You would solve the need for drugs, and I think that people turn to drugs when they don't have access to that fourth state that you call it, or sixth state as Ron Siegel calls it. He says it's a natural human drive, like hunger, thirst, and sex. You know, we need to access that fourth state. It's part of our heritage, or that alternative, that eternal state is what I call it. And so people take to drugs because our society has not provided means of getting there naturally and internally. And so the whole point of the war on drugs is, rather than stop the chemicals by putting people in jail, why not just give them a better route to activate that state of mind?
Everyone has a longing. They have a longing in their soul. They have a longing to belong. And what we're finding now is there is a spot in the brain.
The amygdala, or which part is it?
It's in the left temporal lobe. Some researchers have named it the God spot, which I think is a little bit too haughty. I don't think it has to be. It's a spot that when you touch it through meditative techniques, it gives you a feeling of protection, of belonging, and of bliss.
And this is the part that's stimulated during a near-death experience.
Exactly, yeah, you know about that. Yeah, and the thing is, I've actually been thinking a lot about this, that I don't think a person has to have a near-death experience to see the light. You know,
yeah, I agree.
In the life, they don't have to almost die to realize that maybe they haven't been paying attention to the right priorities. And I think meditation, practice on a daily basis, gives you the awareness to see yourself as the divine person that you are and to live to that grace. And that's really what we all can do very easily, but as we've been saying, we're pretty well shut down from that, except more and more people are opening, especially people involved in your show, are opening to that, and it's a beautiful thing, because as we go further into the 21st century, I believe that we are at a crossroads, and what you'll see is that there will be people who will maintain an intention to stay with the material side of themselves. They will essentially go crazy and drop off the edge of the earth. Mm-hmm. Then you'll have the other side of the fork. As Yogi Berra once said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. If you take that other side to the spiritual development, these people, you know, we will have light. We will enjoy the essence of life. But the most important thing is what we'll find is as we develop the light, people will recognize they'll recognize that light in us. And people you don't know who will mean well, they won't mean you harm. They'll come up to you, and essentially what they'll say is, hey, you have something, I need it, can you please share it with me? I mean, we're all going to become spiritual teachers. We're all going to be needed to give healing energy to people as we go forward, because, as I say, those who maintain the material focus will not be happy. And that's why another reason that I wrote Meditation is Medicine is because, as my teacher told his students when I came here, he said in 1969, Yogi Bhajan said, "I did not come here to gather disciples. I came here to train teachers." So I'm thinking that anybody from any path who is becoming spiritual will be a teacher, will find people coming up to them on many different levels and essentially saying, "Hey, help me." And I think that's why it's so important that we do take the path of the soul.
Well, also it makes life much more satisfying and a much better adventure.
Oh, yeah, we're definitely happier when we do that. Healthy, happy, and holy. That's very good. That's a comment. I think as our birthright as human beings,
exactly.
we should be totally healthy, happy, and whole.
And it's a balancing act, though, to maintain one's status and comfort and necessities in this real world, and also to have a foot in this other eternal part of us. So it's a challenge, but it's well worthwhile.
Well, that's called being a householder, or being someone who has their mind or their consciousness like someone living a meditative lifestyle in a cave in India, but yet they're physically here. They're participating in everyday life. You know, meditation doesn't necessarily have to put you on some kind of far-out other planet. When you meditate, it's about as practical. I think it's the most exquisite form of time management there is. When you start your day with what I call wake up to wellness, with meditation, everything else just falls into place a lot better. Success comes easily. People don't have to struggle. Women can handle all the various time elements in their life without, you know, breaking down.
Because you've recharged your batteries to run your day better.
Yeah, you resurrected yourself every single morning. You renewed yourself to become yourself, and that way you can keep your arms around everything that's going on. We are all in a sandwich generation right now, whether we like it or not. We have aging parents and children and our own self to deal with.
Okay, tell me about your day and how you fit, what spiritual practices you incorporate on a daily basis and how you fit them in.
I wake up, I wake up at a certain time, but it really starts the night before.
Okay.
First of all, you can't eat a heavy meal real late at night and expect to get up early in the morning to meditate. That's called a sadhana buster. And sadhana, or spelled S-A-D-H-A-N-A, is your regular morning spiritual practice that you really have to have if you want to progress on this path. If you do it, you know, at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 days a week, it's nice, but it's just not going to carry over. So it starts the night before. You need to go to bed reasonably early, because remember what the guru said, you want to get up in the Amrit Vela, which is the time before the sun, you know, and ideally you want to get up around 4 or 5 o'clock so you can get a good yoga or sadhana and meditation in, but, you know, even just getting up before the sun is fine. But if you're going to eat a lot of heavy foods the night before, you're still going to be digesting in the morning. It's going to be hard to do that. So you go to sleep, eat lightly, not too late, go to sleep at a reasonable hour. You know, get some good sleep, 7 hours. Maybe you go to sleep at 10, get up at 5. That's good. That's what I do. I go to sleep at 10. I try to get up somewhere around 5 o'clock in the morning every day. And then I do the shower thing and all that, and then I come and my wife also is a yogi, and we get up together in the morning, and then we'll come and tune in, what's called tuning in. And this is described in the book, Meditation is Medicine. So we tune in to a mantra called Ong Namo Guru Dev Namo. It means I bow before my highest consciousness. If this isn't your cup of tea, whoever's listening, you can just simply sit and do long breathing and just tune into your own highest self. Then I do some affirmations and prayers to myself, depending on what's going on in my life. My wife does her own silent things at that point. And then we'll do about between 30 and 45 minutes of Kundalini yoga with stretching, breathing, exercises in a set. And there's some of these are the same ones that I talk about in Meditation is Medicine in my other books, where, you know, you do a set for particular reason. If you want to be more intuitive or relaxed that day, you do that. You want to be elevated or your back's bothering you, you do this. In fact, we sometimes do one called the Green Energy Set, which brings the energy of, money to your life if you need it, or if you have a project going on. And we've been amazed how successful this can be. So we do a specific set. Then we follow that with our morning meditations, and Yogi Bhajan has given 7 morning meditations to do.
Like one for each day of the week, or you
no,
pick
you do
and
them
choose?
All every day. It's probably too much for the average person. It takes, you know, there's 5 7-minute meditations, and then a 22-minute meditation, and another 5 minutes.
This is the advanced course, okay?
Probably too much for the average person, but you know, you can do pick one of the meditations that fits your need from the book, and just do that one. There, some of them are as short as 3 minutes to 11 minutes. You don't have to do the whole yogic thing.
I have about a minute left here.
Okay, now that's it. I'm saying that the most important thing is to wake up early in the morning and do the spiritual practice. That's what I do.
So you get it all done in the morning.
Yeah.
This is helpful. So the rest of your day is free.
Rest of the day is good. I have great energy throughout the day, and occasionally I will in the afternoon just kind of do a little basic
touch
meditation,
up.
And then at night I try to end the day, you know, in a relaxed way.
Wonderful. Well, thanks so much. Appreciate all of your work and really putting the scientific confirmation to an age-old practice and letting us know how we can use meditation as medicine, self-administered, easy to do. His book, Meditation is Medicine, has the complete instructions. It's a very good thing for you to read. That was Dr. Dharma Singh Khalsa. Thanks for listening. I'm Laura Lee.
Laura Lee Online, www.lauralee.com.